During the middle of the 19th century, when the Zionist movement was just beginning to renew the land, a learned correspondence broke out among a number of rabbis in the Pale of the Settlement, in the shtetls of Eastern Europe, who were far better versed in the Talmud than in the news of the day. And the correspondence had to do with whether or not, once Israel was reestablished, Passover could be restored to its original form. According to the Bible, Passover was celebrated in ancient Israel as a great pilgrimage. The men of the townlets around Jerusalem would bring with them to the shrine a lamb from their flocks. And they would bring the lamb to the priests in the temple, who would offer the lamb as a sacrifice. Now, that lamb was not sacrificed as a holocaust, as a sacrifice that was entirely burnt up on the altar. Rather, the blood of the lamb was simply sprinkled about the altar, commemorating the sprinkling of the blood on the doorsteps and the lintels of the Hebrews, the Israelites in Egypt, when God passed over their doors, sparing their firstborn. And the lamb itself was then taken, and it was roasted. And then the men would take the roast lamb to a hall which they had hired, a dining hall in Jerusalem. And they would have a commemorative meal, a communion meal. They'd eat the lamb and other things at a feast. And the feast would be one at which they would rehearse the events of the redemption that was, the Exodus, and of the redemption that they hoped would be, their deliverance from all the political misfortunes of the day. And the rabbis in this correspondence were wondering whether or not this older form of sacrifice, of ritual, of pilgrimage might be reestablished once Israel came to being as a Jewish national home. And there are a number of wonderfully elegant halachic problems involved in this issue. Must we wait for the coming of the Messiah in order to reestablish the cult, the shrine? There are in the Talmud a number of rules which govern the purification of the shrine if it's to be rededicated. And among those rules, there's one which requires the sprinkling over the shrine area of the blood of a red heifer, called Egla Agrufa. And they went on at some length in this correspondence to try to decide whether or not there still existed the strain of red heifers which might be properly used in this particular ritual. And on this rabbinic correspondence went, until one spoil sport happened to receive the sheaf of letters. And then he circulated a letter of his own in which he wondered in print whether or not these learned rabbis knew that the shrine area was now a mosque and that the Muslims were unlikely to be willing to dismantle their mosque so that the Jews might again establish their temple. Thus ended that correspondence. Now, it's a delightful bit of history which reminds us in passing how insular and isolated and medieval Jewish life remained in Eastern Europe until modernity was suddenly thrust upon it, either by the intrusion of machines and foreign ideas, or because the people of that world had suddenly to leave it. And in the passage from the Carpathian Mountains to the east side of New York, a passage which often took them less than 6 weeks, they had suddenly to move from this isolated and insulated medieval world where they were totally unaware of what was happening in the larger world to the hustle and the bustle of a great modern Western metropolis. But I cite it here this morning not so much for this sense that it gives us of the world of our great-grandparents, but because it reminds us that Seder night, was never intended to be a night where a script was given to us, a book which had in it all of the themes, all of the text, all of the ideas that we should speak and use that night, and where we simply begin on page one and read on through to the conclusion, and in doing so we have fulfilled the mitzvah, the duty of Passover. Not at all. That original Passover in Temple days was an improvisation. There was no text. And the word we use for the book, which is still ours, Haggadah, suggests that fact. It means simply the telling. It is the skeleton, the outline of a happening. It picks up a number of themes which were used in those ancient days, themes about the Exodus, themes about redemption, and by giving us a number of rituals which around which we can weave our ideas, it allows us to express in a relevant and contemporary way our concerns as to what is the substance, the content, the meaning of the theme of freedom, of the theme of deliverance, of the theme of divine redemption as it applies to our own lives. I say this because I want to make a comment about Seder modern American style. As sure as I'm standing here, our office will receive tomorrow a phone call from a frantic hostess. And she will say, in its essence, help. I've planned a wonderful meal. I've got 25 people coming. And I suddenly realize we don't have any Haggadot. And there are any number of men who tomorrow night, fathers and grandfathers, I don't mean to sound male chauvinist by that, but that's usually the way Seder is organized, who will be responsible for the organization of the Seder service itself, who will not give it a thought during the day, and will simply come home and pick up the book and assume they can begin on page one and provide the direction for a meaningful service. Now, the kitchen is fully prepared. We haven't lost, thank God, the art of knedlach. But we're so unprepared so often as to those things which are of the heart of the moment, the heart of the ritual. And what I want to make as a point to you this morning is this. The Haggadah is not a full script. It's not intended to provide you with all of the ideas, all of the words, all of the themes with which you ought to be concerned tomorrow night. We ourselves have to involve our minds, our concerns, in the evening if we're to give it shape and meaning and grace. And so what I'd like to do this morning is to suggest to you something about the Haggadah to help you begin to think about it so that tomorrow night when we open the book, it can have some deeper meanings, some resonances it might not otherwise have for us. And the first comment I'd like to suggest to make is that the Haggadah is not a history book, and that Seder night is not intended to be an historical commemoration of the Exodus from Egypt. If it were a history book, it would begin with the commissioning of Moses at the burning bush and would rehearse the story, much as it's told in the Torah, of God's redemption of the people, their march out of Egypt, the pursuit of the Egyptians, the crossing of the Reed Sea, the rebellions, the murmurings against Moses in the wilderness, the giving of the covenant to Moses at Mount Sinai, and so on. But as you know, that's not at all the way the Haggadah proceeds. It proceeds on the basis of the four questions which our children ask, questions which do not go to, which are not of this order. Why do we rehearse tonight the Exodus from Egypt? Or why did God decide to bring the Jews out of Egypt? That's not the questions they ask. Why tonight do we eat matzah? Why tonight do we eat reclining rather than sitting up straight? Why tonight do we dip twice rather than once? The questions have to do with the moment itself, with the happening, with what the child observes. And the answers deal also with the moment, with what ought to be happening to us, with what we ought to be thinking about. And the basic theme of this happening is the basic religious theme, the theme of redemption. What it is that gives life beauty and meaning. What it is which takes this experience which we call living, which is full of the accidental, which is brief, which is bruising, which is uncertain, and allows us to feel that this life can have beauty, that all the accidents that happen to us nevertheless seem to show that there's some larger purpose, that there is reason to do the right, to serve the causes which we believe to be good and to be just. If you want to remind yourself of the purpose of the Haggadah, remind yourself of the presence of Elijah in the Seder service. On the table, there is the cup for Elijah. At one point in the service, someone will go and open the door for Elijah. And Elijah, of course, is that mythic personage who, according to the folk tradition, is the messenger of the Messiah. When he comes, the Messiah will not be far behind. And so what we have in this myth, in this theme, is the association of Seder night with freedom, with redemption, with all the hopes that we have about our lives and the lives of our country and of our world. Now, there are those of you who, like the wise son, who know how to ask, who will say to me, but Rabbi, the association of Elijah in this sense with the Seder is very late. The Seder is an old tradition, and there's no reference to Elijah in the Talmudic tradition as far as his relationship with the Seder. It's not until medieval times that we call this the cup of Elijah, or that we open the door for Elijah. And if you said this to me, I'd beam with delight that I'd finally had done my job and that Jewish knowledge was flourishing in our congregation, because you would be correct. The idea of the cup of Elijah did not begin as a theme of a place setting to which we will invite the messenger of good tidings. Not at all. It began because in Talmudic times, 1800 years ago, there was a great rabbinic debate. How many cups of wine, how many blessings over how many cups of wine are to be served during the feast? Traditionally, the feast was determined by its bounty. And since it was supposed to be a great statement of freedom, the one day in the year in which the Jew could assume himself to be a totally free man, he was to organize the Seder night, the feast, with largesse. But the rabbis, of course, have to associate every theme with the Torah, every theme with God's instructions. And so they located a text in the sixth chapter of Exodus in which God makes a promise, or a series of promises, about the deliverance. And in that text, God says, in essence, I will bring you out, I will deliver you, I will redeem you, I will take you forth. There are four promises of deliverance. But the sentence also ends with a promise, I will bring you in into the promised land. And so there were rabbis who said we must have at least four cups, not simply as a statement of bountifulness, of largesse, of our being free, but we must have five. Five for the fifth promise of the entry into the promised land. And there were those who were more literalist who said, no, only the four promises of deliverance have to do with the Passover. The fifth is an important promise, but it's not part of the theme of the day. And they debated this issue back and forth and back again, and of course there was no answer. So the solution was to bless the four cups and to put the fifth cup on the table to show that this was a valid opinion. And then there grew up a folk tradition in another context that a number of these issues, which could not be resolved by the rabbis, you can see they're terribly serious, vital issues, would be resolved at the end of time by Elijah himself, who would bring down the final word. So this fifth cup, which was sitting on the table from old times, came to be called the cup of Elijah, because Elijah would resolve the issue. And when we turn to the question of opening the door for Elijah, opening a door has always been, as far as we know, a part of the Seder service. But originally it had another purpose, and it came at another time during the Seder worship. The oldest prayer we have in the Seder is an Aramaic prayer, which begins the Haggadah. Ha lachma anya, diahalu ahavatna d'ara d'mitzrayim. This is the bread of affliction, which our fathers ate in the land of Egypt. Kol dithin yefte v'yechol. Let all who are hungry come and eat. It was a mitzvah, it was a duty for the Jew, Seder night, to welcome anyone to his table. The sense of hospitality is fortunately one we haven't lost. We make sure at our Seder that anyone who is without a family in the town, any stranger, any college student who's here, is brought into our home and given a place. And as symbol of that mitzvah, the duty to bring into your home anyone who might not have been able to arrange a Seder feast for himself, the door was opened at this early point in the service, in those early days. But then in the medieval period, the canards of anti-Semitism came to include the charge that Jews slaughtered a Christian child before the Passover to use its blood as a necessary part of the Seder service. The custom charge seems to have grown up around the idea that when they recited each of the 10 plagues, they would take their finger, whoever was conducting the service, and dip it in the cup of wine and flick a drop of wine on the floor as each of the 10 plagues were recited. And of course, since one of the plagues deals with the taking of a life, the taking of blood, the association seems to have come out of this. So Jews got in the habit, a necessary survival habit, of opening the door at about that point in the service so that everyone could see that, in fact, no blood was used, that no Christian child had been murdered, because many a community was decimated and annihilated because of this charge. And as a matter of fact, those of you who associate red wine with the Passover might be interested to know that during the medieval period, our people switched from red wine to light wine precisely to counter this charge, precisely to make it evident that there was no blood, nothing dark associated with the Seder. And then after the medieval period, when it was no longer necessary for us to prove that what was untrue was in fact untrue, the rabbis, not willing to let these custom remained simply a survival instinct, associated the opening of the door at this later time has become customary with the coming of Elijah, this theme of redemption. So Elijah's association with the Seder is relatively recent, only a few centuries old. But the association of Elijah of redemption did not graft onto the Seder any unnatural theme. Rather, it picked up the theme which had been essential to the Seder from the very beginning. We see it in the texts. As you know, every Seder ends L'shana haba'a b'Yerushalayim, next year in Jerusalem. The theme is our redemption, not the redemption of the Israelites from Egypt. The prayer which I read to you, began to read, to speak to you of, that is so old, is in Aramaic, which begins the service. This is the bread of affliction which our fathers ate in the land of Egypt. Let all who are hungry come and eat. Let all who are in need come and join our Passover festival. Continues, Hashata haha, l'shana haba'a d'ara d'Israel, this year here, next year in the land of Israel, Hashata avde, l'shana haba'a b'nei chorin, this year we are slaves, next year may we be free. And if you look at the Haggadah itself, you'll notice a fact I've commented on before. And that is that if the Haggadah were a history book, it would tell how Moses was the ambassador, the agent of God in the deliverance from Egypt, and the prophet of God, and the giving of the Ten Commandments, and the covenant at Mount Sinai. But Moses is never mentioned in the Haggadah. And Aaron, his spokesman, is never mentioned in the Haggadah. The Haggadah speaks only of God. It is the God who redeemed. It is a God who delivered. It is a God who parted the Red Sea. And when we sing that lovely little song, Dayenu, it would have been enough for us. As we try to scalpel down the gift, which is redemption, and we see all of its component parts, the reminder to all of us not to gobble down gulp down the great happy moments of our life, but to see every element which is involved in it so we can truly appreciate how much that is good is happening to us. When in the Dayenu, it's Ilu Hotzi Hotzianu, if God had delivered us. Ilu Natan Natan Lanu, if God had given us the Torah. Not God gave through Moses, but it is a God who gives. The theme is existential. The moment is a happening. The essential idea of the Seder service is that we are still in need of redemption. Now, there's an ancient common assumption, we might call it a superstition among human beings, that certain days are lucky days and certain days are unlucky days. And if something good happened to us on a certain day in our youth, somehow that day is always set down as a day on which good things will happen to us from then on out. We have such days in our religious tradition. Tisha B'Av, the ninth day of Av, is celebrated as a fast day. Why is it a fast day? Because according to tradition, it was on the ninth of Av that the first temple was destroyed. And according to tradition, it was on the ninth of Av that the Romans destroyed the second temple. And you can find in Talmudic literature a whole list of the terrible things that happened to our people on the ninth of Av over time. Well, the 14th of Nisan, tomorrow night, the 14th of Nisan is a happy day. It's a deliverance day. It's called, or rather, deliverance night. It's called Leil Shimurim, the night of watching. And our people instinctively assumed that if it was on the 14th of Nisan that God began the redemption of the Israelites from Egypt, it would be on the 14th of Nisan that he would begin the redemption of his people at some time in the future. This was the night, Dathila Di'ula, of the beginning of the redemptive process. And those who participated in more pious, more simpler times in the Seder ritual literally assumed that they were, in a sense, participating in a moment which was pregnant with possibility, where there was truly the reason to hope that a major change, a cataclysmic change, would take place in the nature of the world because the Messianic age was about to dawn and the beginning would be then. They didn't literally believe that Elijah would be at the door when they opened it, but they did believe that if redemption was to come that year, it would come this night, Seder night. And so the theme is our participation, our need to be redeemed. And if you look at the Seder, you find again and again that we are, the tenses become confused. We are to consider ourselves as if it was we who were part of the redemption from Egypt. This is our moment, our concern. And so when the rabbis embroider the earliest, simplest skeleton of the Seder service, they began to consider what it is that redemption consists of. And interestingly, there are in the text, the simple text of the Seder, two answers to this question. And they were put there by the two men who founded the great flourishing of Babylonian Jewry in the 3rd century. The great renaissance of Jewish learning in Babylon, which led to the creation of the centers at Sura and Hardea and Nisibis and Pumpedita, which led ultimately to the compilation of the Babylonian Talmud. And these two men are known to us as Samuel and Rav. They were very different personalities, but they were contemporaries. Samuel was an earthy, this-worldly type, a brilliant scholar, pious man, head of an academy, but also one who was very much with it in terms of the political and social and economic needs of the day. He was a very wealthy man, he was a successful businessman, who was entrusted during his busy career with most of the critical assignments in the bureaucracy of the Jewish community. His was a leadership role, and he looked up to the issues practically. And to a man of Samuel's type, the essence of the Seder, the essence of redemption, lies in political liberation. He was very much a contemporary of ours. We live in a century in which we assume that political liberation must precede all other kinds of progress. That until a country or people rule themselves, they cannot hope to solve the economic and the social and the human problems which confront their social order. And so we've seen all over our world in the last century, century and a half, the development of movements of national liberation, Zionism among them. Rav, on the other hand, was a more introspective type. He was not a businessman, therefore he did not become a rich man. He was not a politico, and therefore he was never appointed to any of the major positions in the Jewish community. He was a bookman. He was a meditative kind of person. And to Rav, the essence of freedom lies in freeing oneself from one's ignorance, from all those things which limit our ability to accept life and to live with dignity in life and to control the passions and the fears and the anxieties which otherwise torment us in life. And each of them began his Seder in a different way. There is a paragraph, which is Samuel's, which begins one element in the service. Avadim hayinu lefaro b'Mitzrayim. We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and God brought us out with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. To the man of affairs, to the realist, if you will, redemption begins in national liberation. Now, he was well aware that once the Jews were out of Egypt, they hadn't really yet got control of themselves. They murmured against Moses, take us back to the flesh pots of Egypt. But national liberation to Samuel was a sine qua non, the thing you couldn't do without, the necessary first step. Rav, on the other hand, began his interpretation of redemption with a different paragraph. L'tchila ovdei avodah zarah hayu avotenu. In the beginning, our fathers worshipped idols. And then Abraham, he goes back to Abraham. And then Abraham saw the folly of idol worship and committed himself and us to the worship of the one God. To Rav, redemption begins in freeing ourselves of the ignorance, of the superstition, of the follies of our age, and coming to a true understanding of ourselves, of what is required of us, of the world in which we're a part. Now, both men are right. In a sense, obviously a people cannot be free while they're still being tyrannized. Obviously colonials cannot have control over destiny as long as other governments are twisting their economies to suit their needs rather than the needs of those who are native to the place. But surely we've lived long enough into the 20th century to know that after every movement of national liberation, we recognize that the nation is still filled with problems. That often one set of tyrants takes over from the set of tyrants who have been imposed from without, and a tyrant from one's own people can be as vicious as one who is sent there from abroad. And surely we recognize now that national liberation at the very best is only the beginning, a pedestal from which we can begin to work with the other problems of society, and only as we transform ourselves, gain control of our anxieties and passions, only as we become constructive citizens can we hope to create a better society. And so we have in the Seder service not reference to archaic history, not a rehearsal of events which happened 3,000 years ago and have a quaint, archaic value for us today. But we have the lifting up of some basic questions which face all of us every day, which face all our governments whenever they make decisions. Where do you put your priority? Is the priority in the world to liberate every group and every people? Should the priority be to work individually with ourselves, with our families, with those we are closest, to bring enlightenment, to bring learning, to bring some sense of purpose and quality and self-discipline? The issue is very live. It's very real, immediate, if you will. What is it which will allow us as a world to take advantage of the miraculous research and technology, the new machinery, the new possibilities which the last two centuries have placed into our hands? We no longer expect a Messiah. To a very large degree, we have created the wherewithal, the research, the medicine, the machinery, which should allow our world to enjoy some measure of prosperity. But clearly ours is a convulsed world. And clearly our machines and our sciences have brought us as much heartache and pain as they have liberation and opportunity. In what does redemption consist? Was Samuel right? To what degree was he right? Was Rav right? To what degree was he in the right? And these themes are worth, I would submit to you, serious consideration around our Seder table. What is the value of freedom? In what does freedom consist? What responsibilities necessarily go along with being free? And how can mankind ultimately free itself from the agonies which continue to plague it until this day? There's much more to the Seder, of course. It's a glorious moment. It's a family moment. It's a warm, happy moment. The Elijah is spoken of in the Seder sense only once in the Bible. In the book of Malachi, in the last chapter of that book, we're told that when Elijah comes, the hearts of the children shall be turned to the parents, and the hearts of the parents shall be turned to the children. Seder night is that kind of night. It's the night when the child can shine, singing or chanting or saying the Manishtana. It's the time when we can reward the child for finding the Afikoman, and we can draw him close to us in a religious tradition and a religious rite which has beauty and hopefully which has grace. But for all of us, at whatever level of understanding we bring to the Seder, for all of us, these deeper themes, these larger issues are worthy of consideration. And I hope that you won't rush through the service to get to the meal, that you'll spend time and linger over some of them, because I know the temptation. I like knedelich as much as you do. Amen.